I am speaking with author and musician Ned Sublett. He will be in Kalamazoo for a couple of events, including the first public reading of his forthcoming book, The American Slave Coast. Ned, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Explain what led you to actually writing this book.
This book really unpacked from a previous book. I sort of think of it, you know, like a chain smoker lighting one cigarette off the butt of another. One book leads me to another one. And in my second book, The World That Made New Orleans, there's a chapter called The Slave Breeding Industry. This was published 5 years ago. And the book's been very popular, and there's been a lot of writing about it, but hardly anyone mentions that chapter. And to me, it's almost the core of the book, and it's a core thing you have to understand about American history. And I realized this needed to be broken out into a book of its own. It's been on my mind for years. Now, I should mention that the book is co-authored with my wife, though she doesn't travel for these kinds of events much. But so it's by Ned and Constance Sublett, and I can't tell you the pleasure that gives me.
Working together with your wife turned out well, huh?
It's a dream come true.
Where did you turn for your research? Because I've read a draft and there are some quotes from actual slaves. Where did you find those?
There's a great deal of documentation, really. I mean, there's not much considering there were 4 million enslaved people in 1860. It's very, very little. But the voices are not completely silent. We have 101 books that were published by fugitive slaves, the so-called slave narratives, including a movie, the movie 12 Years a Slave, that has just come out, is a very meticulous, historically accurate filming of one of the best known of those, 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. Frederick Douglass's is probably the best known, his autobiography. But there's a lot of them, and they're quite gripping. First of all, that. Then there's an enormous number of interviews that were done mostly in the 1930s by the Federal Writers Project of the Works Progress Administration, where they interviewed formerly enslaved people who were by then quite elderly, but there were, I think, about 2,000 of those. And the more you look at them, just the more certain things just reinforce and come back over and over. So it is possible to get something of a sense of what the enslaved thought.
How much was the slave trade about pure economics?
Oh, entirely. This is a book about economics, really. The thing that you have to understand about chattel slavery in the United States, and this was really a unique invention of American entrepreneurship. It didn't work this way in the other slave territories of the hemisphere, except briefly in Brazil, is that people were money. Slavery was not merely a system of labor. It was also a system of property rights, which is to say that you could make money by selling the crop an enslaved laborer produced. You could make money by hiring out the enslaved person's labor, but you could, of course, sell the person. People were savings accounts. The South did not have much in the way of hard currency, gold or silver, and the money was very flaky, especially in the antebellum years after President Jackson privatized the money, and money was being issued by 1,600 different banks that all depreciated the farther away from the bank you got. People were the best, solidest place to put your money. And much of the collateral of the South's credit system was people. Mortgages were backed by the value of a planter's estate, which was primarily the value of the laborers. Land was worth very little without labor to work it. So the people, the 4 million people who were enslaved in 1860, were $4 billion worth of property, which could be used as the base for the collateral of the credit system of the South. So when slavery ended, the money imploded.
Was the system also based on believing that a group of people, specifically a race of people, was inferior or perhaps even less than human?
That became more and more of a belief the longer the South committed to to chattel slavery, I think. By the 1830s, there was this general belief developed in the South that slavery was God's law. It was God's will that humans were naturally divided into masters and slaves. By this point, the Northern and Southern churches had pretty much diverged. And the Southern evangelicals preached, masters, be kind to your slaves. Slaves, serve your masters with all your heart in the love of Christ. The belief here is that there was a two-caste system was necessary to maintain the money. So racism was convenient in terms of keeping people enslaved. If people are money, children are interest, which is why slave owners had to own the children, so that no matter how light-skinned that baby might be, if it was born from an enslaved woman, he or she was considered to be of that darker race. Race is, of course, a cultural construct. It's pretty much a biologically useless concept. So racism, which is a system, not merely an individual ignorant prejudice, racism really reinforced the economic interests of the large slaveholders of the South.
You've mentioned the movie 12 Years a Slave. In broad terms, however, has popular culture created some myths about slavery and the relationship between the slaves and their owners?
Oh, it certainly has. One reason I don't really like movies much is because so much history has been distorted. It was astonishing to see 12 Years a Slave, how careful they were to get it all right. There was a movie recently that you may have heard of called Django Unchained, which had a person being a bounty hunter in the South before the Civil War. There was no such thing, let alone all the rest of the distortions in that film. But going back all the way to the beginning of movies, they distorted this history. You know, in Gone with the Wind, my God, there's never a mention of a slave being sold. Slave market does not exist in Gone with the Wind. And before that, of course, the notorious first great movie spectacular, the deeply racist D.W. Griffith film, The Birth of a Nation, which inspired the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan on a national scale. Yes, popular culture has very largely distorted this history over the years. What we're doing in this book is telling the history that leaps out at you if you go back and read the primary documents but are not part of the child's version of American history. One of the problems of explaining this in school is that slavery is not a fit subject for children. It gets into things we'd rather children not know about. You have already this need to euphemize, but then, of course, following the end of the slavery war or the Civil War, there was a heavy revision of history done that lasted for decades in a vision of a nostalgic South in which the slaves were not really treated so badly. That really lasted as almost a dominant meme in historiography up until fairly recent times. The Civil Rights era was a great awakening for American history. And since then, there's been an enormous amount of good work being done. So it is possible to know the history correctly, but you're sure not going to get it from most movies.
I had a high school teacher who called Gone with the Wind great romance, lousy history.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. True. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As I noted, you're a musician, and some of your previous writing has been about music. Was this a departure for you to get in so heavily into history like this?
Well, all my books have been about history. So, in a sense, no. But also, this is the first book that I have done that is not heavily about music. Music comes in. It's part of my way of understanding history. I call it post-Mamboism, you know, understanding the world through your ears, taking music as the central point of departure or understanding and using music to interrogate all the other disciplines. That's how I understand history, geography, all the rest of it. So music's here is an undercurrent, but no, it's not. And that also allows me to collaborate with my wife, because my wife always says she was my history teacher. We just we discussed absolutely every single point of this book together, read the sources together. We couldn't have done that with a music book because my wife doesn't know music. She's a happy listener, but she's not a musician on a technical level, doesn't really know music history per se. So that wouldn't have allowed us to work together. I've been moving more and more in the direction of straight-up history, but music always comes back.